nice to be here. It's my first time in Santa Cruz and a long time since I've been in California. And it was really great to get the ocean whiff and just the vibe of California. I dig it. I was born in Southern California, so it's good to be back. And so I'm partially here to spend time with Kokyo. Dharma friends are so vital. But also to attend this retreat with Sukhni Rinpoche. And then a couple of weeks ago, I did some retreat with another one of my teachers, whose name is Keith Dauman. How's my amplification?
Very good.
Very good. A little too good. Got it. Got it. Okay. Hello, check, check. How's that sound? Yeah, good. Great, okay. Good. So I'm attending a retreat with a teacher I'll meet for the first time sometime tomorrow. And then one of my other teachers is in the Dzogchen lineage. I did some retreat with him a couple weeks ago. And then recently I completed a Dharma transmission with Chozen and Hogen. I kind of have two teachers at the monastery, whom I've lived with day in and day out now for about 14 years. And so, student, and what that is, has been on my mind, and reflecting on the importance of it, partially as I've worked with a lot of teachers over the years of my practice, some peripherally, some really intensely, and then now I'm starting to mentor some students, and seeing it from that side of the equation a little bit differently. So I want to talk about the student mind. And you know, the teacher-student dynamic in spiritual practice, I think you could give a whole conference to. It's something that could be really unpacked, especially for committed people. There's lots there. So I'm only just going to barely scratch the surface here. It's worthy of a lot of exploration, I think. So Dogen Zenji in the Rahai Tokuzui, many of you may know that, sometimes called Attaining the Marrow. He has a line that has stuck with me for years, and that is, as long as there is bowing in the world, there will be Buddha Dharma in the world. But when there is no bowing in the world, there will be no Buddha Dharma. What is bowing? He doesn't just mean the physical act of prostration. He does not mean that either. But what is the heart, what's the posture of the heart when we bow? What is that inviting or invoking? What is that expressing with our bodies? So in our zendos, we bow to Manjushri. We bow to each other, we bow to teachers sometimes, we bow to empty cushions. And I think bowing, one aspect of that is a way to embody the question or the longing to become permeable, the longing to be open and undefended to the Dharma. Maybe just to be open and undefended to our life as it comes forward from all directions all the time. So in the Tibetan tradition, some of you may know that often before you receive a certain level of teaching, you've done all kinds of practice of bowing. What is it, 10,000 or 100,000 bows to ready the heart as a receptacle for the precious teaching. So at least as an idea, beginner's mind is appealing to most of us. At least as a slogan for American Zen people, we really like the idea of beginner's mind. That sounds really good. Beginner's mind. But in practice, this is really not so easy to maintain for all the various reasons that we congeal into knowledge. Out of insecurity, or out of a longing for authority, or out of just sheer repetition of the teachings, You know, the brain gets tired of hearing the same thing, and before you know it, just filters out. And so beginner's mind is appealing, if not actualized by us in this practice, a lot of the time. And sometimes we are in touch with our need to see deeper into reality. Sometimes we're not. Now, sometimes we see more clearly into the constructed self. The need to understand really the pivotal question of what am I at a more fundamental level. Sometimes we see more or less clear our karmic patterning and how that ripples out in the hair trigger habits of suffering that we have, especially around our families and our coworkers and those who just, we have that sort of karmic friction with. So when we're in this place of beginner's mind, the moment, can I say that? The moment of beginner's mind? Because it's not a permanent state, obviously. It's a precious vulnerability. That's the thing. To remain a student means to remain vulnerable. To not only have your authority in a practice and kind of your hara about what is real and who you are, but at the same time, how to be soft and receptive. So that precious vulnerability, we know that we don't know something. We don't always know that. Another quote from Dogen. We chant the Genjo Koan at Great Vow quite often as a daily practice, as part of our noon service. And so these lines over the years have sort of seeped into my bones, and they come up around different aspects of life. And in thinking about this issue of student mind, this line from Dogen came up. He says, when truth fills your body and mind, you realize something is missing. When truth fills your body and mind, you realize that something is missing. Not before it's filling your body and mind, but when truth is filling your body and mind, there's a sense of, okay, this isn't the whole picture. It's a communication of the heart. So that's the presence of truth in our lives, that there's more that meets the eye. We haven't fixated on what or how things are. Another way to hear his line might be, when truth fills my body and mind, I realize I'm not living to my fullest capacity. I'm not fully embodying the reality of who I am. Maybe I can't, but am I at least making the effort? Am I inclining in that way? So in those times of beginner's mind, those precious times, which as all things, they flicker, they pass, they come, they go, it needs to be nurtured, we can practice a receptive mind. And receptive mind doesn't mean that we're sort of putting our ear to every stone and pebble or reading every book on the shelf. It's more an attitude. It's a quality, I think, of awareness in which all things can teach. And we don't know what. Right? It's a surprise what comes forward. But because of our attitude, the invitation is there. So a pot boiling over. I recently was the head cook for a very big retreat at the monastery. We were feeding like 80 people, and I was cooking breakfast. And I actually hadn't been in the kitchen for a while, and I was afraid I was getting rusty. And it turns out it was true in a very small way. I lifted the lid off a pot with the water was boiling, really kind of unattentively, and steam flew up, and I got this big burn on my arm. And I had been in the Tenzo for like 2 years and cooked for dozens of sessions and thousands of meals, and just that moment of inattentiveness was revealed to me. by the steam pot. So I had to bow to the steam pot. All things can teach a sarcastic comment from a coworker or a loved one. When we're in the ego position, we're just offended. And immediately there's right and wrong. But if we're in that place of the student mind, we go, oh, what is my reactivity about? There's something here. Something is being shown to me. In a way, it turns your life 180 degrees. A life that could just be filled with a bunch of inconveniences and people who just don't quite have it right, kind of get in my way as I try to plow through my day from pleasure to pleasure. When I have this mind of everything can teach me, I'm continually being trained. Actually, in a way, lay life is really ideal for this. Because I've lived in the monastery for a long time, and people at least try to put on their nice face. Everyone's trying to be a good Buddhist or a good Zen student. But probably in the streets of Santa Cruz, people don't give a crap. And if you have the right attitude, you can be really empowered by that. Because it's all teaching. It's a continual training. So in the student mind, we can dwell in a reflecting forth of our own state of mind. Have you noticed that how you see and what you see are one? There's the old Sufi saying that, in a crowd of saints, a pickpocket sees only wallets. So the more we are alert and sensitive, and actually the more we're infused with bodhicitta, and how to do that is a question I have and also worthy of really looking at. The more we're infused with the vow to wake up, the more that's rooted in us, the more the world responds. Sometimes I have this experience in retreat or in zazen that I'm on the edge of really just drifting off into like a long daydream, like one of those where I'm really gone. You know? And all of a sudden, right on that lip, a crow, caw, caw! Right there is the perfect Buddha manifestation at that very moment, bringing me back. Or those times, and this one, these I really love, and I feel like this is so important for it to happen, and Sangha is part of how it happens. You have a fixed picture about somebody. You know how the mind just settles on how somebody is? Oh, she is just... Whenever the mind says always, you know it's delusion, actually. She is always grumpy when she has to set up the incense, you know, whatever. He is always this way when he comes home. Because all beings are continually arising fresh. So whenever we say always, that's, you know, President Trump is not an always. Your worst enemy is not an always. Everybody is a fluid manifestation. So anyways, I love it when I have an always that I'm not conscious of. Sometimes they're quiet. And then that person who I had thought of as, let's say, selfish, does this random act of love for me. And then I have to really look and see how deluded I had been and just how I had been living from this narrow idea. And that doesn't happen unless we have this student attitude, which is so beautiful. So in thinking about student mind, this is one aspect. This is actually the first place I orient when I think about it, because not everybody can work with a human teacher. And that's not always the best thing. So you meet many people who seem to be really mature human beings who never worked in this kind of formal setting, but they'll tell you, oh, nature is my teacher. You know, my cat's my teacher. Raising my children taught me the Dharma. So the world as teacher, all phenomena as teacher. You know, one of the things about nature I think is interesting is your humanness and your human reactivities and way of looking at things are just not reflected back to you in the forest. But the tree is exactly itself. The leaves are precisely a leaf. You know, the wind is not saying anything about your predicament. But it's saying something. It's saying something very, very intimate. So the world as teacher, all phenomena as teacher, I mean, even our own delusions as teacher. So if you sit zazen and you can say, oh, that's deluded, well, that's wisdom speaking. But that doesn't come forth unless you're deluded. Isn't that interesting? It's just totally tied up. So everything has this kind of presence of clarity when we're open. So, but what about the human teacher? So again, the human teacher could be the politician that mirrors something about what we contain. Or the human teacher could be the person who embodies the quality that we're reactive to when we go, okay, why am I reactive? It's, you know, to study the way is to study the self. So for us as practitioners, the finger always has to start here. You know, it's not that there are no victims or no people who are unskillful in this world, but our reactivity is about me. So, but what about the human teacher in the more traditional sense? I want to reflect on that a little bit. There's the old saying that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. It might be when the student is ready and willing. A little bit more fleshed out, the teacher appears. Sometimes in my lineage, we say there are two aspects to practice. You could boil it down. There's essence and there's expression. And so essence is what Zazen teaches us. That we release the body, mind into presence. And we let go of everything that can be let go of. When you're completely in that moment of being totally uninvolved with all that dances in your experience, that dance of impermanence, when you're not involved with any of that, what remains? What is it that's at the core? What's really the heart of Zazen? Who is doing it? This is about essence. But it has to be lived. You know, Kokyo mentioned that we do a koan study at in the White Plum lineage and a Great Vow, and sometimes it just from the outside the koans seem like a bunch of weird riddles or like, oh, koans are about breaking the conceptual mind. Okay. But another part of the koans is how do you live these insights you have on the cushion? How do you live the truth of transparency and wholeness? So, a teacher can show me how to live the insight of Zazen, can be a model of that. But a tree can't. A tree doesn't have human relationships. A tree doesn't have a mortgage. A tree doesn't get life-threatening illness that it is wrapped with panic about. A tree doesn't have uncertainty about its livelihood. But a human being can model how do you live the Dharma in those situations. How is it done? How is this practice carried in the body? A sky can't show me that. A sky can reflect to me the nature of awareness, but a sky can't tell me how do I take care of my chores. How does the practice penetrate when I get on the internet? A book can't truly show me that with all its beautiful and inspiring ideas. So a human teacher. There's a little story about what I consider my heart teacher. So I work with different teachers, but at the monastery, Hogen and Chosen are the abbots. But I resonated with a Hogen at first because of one particular Adokusan I had with him. So I had moved to Portland, and I think that unknowingly I had just kind of stumbled into, I don't know if you use this terminology, spiritual crisis. I think this is useful terminology. And what I was experiencing was I was doing all this Zazen practice and looking at myself in the light of the teachings, and I was beginning to deconstruct my idea of who I thought I was, and I didn't know what to do with that. I didn't have the support for that. I didn't have other people to tell me what was going on. I had just thrown myself into it. And so I was in a spiritual crisis and confused and depressed, because what I thought mattered didn't matter anymore, and it was not depression in the usual sense. Anyways, so my memory of myself was that I was in a place of real vulnerability and a confusion about what I needed to do, and in a place of low self-esteem. I think that there's a time when all of our unaddressed childhood traumas rise up to be looked, to be held in awareness. And so that was happening. So anyways, I go into interview, and it's not so much what Hogan said, but it was the first time I had ever been held by somebody who was hearing my story in complete non-judgmental awareness. This person was sitting there, and I could feel him intimately with me, and I was in tears. I was in this state of gnarliness. I don't know how to put words to it. And there was nothing but love. I didn't catch a whiff of judgment. I didn't feel like I needed to be other than I was at that moment. And he fully communicated that. And that's when I decided I was going to go to Great Vow, actually, from that experience. The other thing was that I asked him if I should come to the monastery. I wanted someone to tell me what I should do. I wanted to give away my agency to somebody. And he immediately said that you have to decide that. And then I trusted him, because he didn't empowered me in that moment. So some of the teachings, for example, in the Soto lineage, they emphasize you should spend as much time with your teacher as possible. Maybe to your teacher's dismay, but you should spend as much time with your teacher as possible, because you just watch how they live. And that doesn't mean that you're watching a perfect saint in action. You watch how they really try to live the Dharma, and you see the beauty of that and where that really feels true, and you also see where you feel like, this doesn't quite right. And that's information too. But we're mutually implicated as human beings in our imperfection. So there's just living and watching the day-to-day activity, and you know, so for example with, I mentioned Keith Dauman, one of the teachers I'm studying with. So he's a guy who's been studying Dharma for like 60 years or something. 50 years. He went to Nepal in his 20s. And he's a translator, and I feel like he's a very wise man. And when he takes a teaching seat, he has just a lot of power and confidence. But I went out to dinner with him recently with some teenagers. And he had no trace of ageism. He was just completely receptive to what these people had to say. And really willing to just listen and be and embody that receptivity. And so I learned something from that just by watching how he was with people. So that's one aspect is the modeling of behavior. And another crucial function, I think, is the teacher as a mirror. So one of the most interesting things I find is that we actually can't see ourselves. Have you ever listened to your own voice recorded back on tape and gone, "Who the hell said that? Who is that? Is that me?" And you're surprised at how you sound? So we don't know how we sound, but we also don't know how we're experienced by others. So right now, there are 20 different versions of me in this room. Because whatever this is coming through your perspective, your experience, your wisdom, and your filters. So I get a reflection back from my community and people around me, but I can't actually see myself. I just get little hints of what I might be. Once a friend of mine, we were literally talking about looking in the mirror, and she said, you know, you can't see yourself in the mirror. And I was a little irritated by that, but then I would try, and I realized you can never actually see how you look in the mirror, in the physical mirror, because you inevitably, when you look in the mirror, you change how you look. You try to like make the face that looks like you would like to look, or kind of, you know. I don't really like the wrinkles on my forehead, so I try to smile in such a way that they get diminished. So a teacher is somebody that you trust to be a mirror. And you want them to mirror you because you want to be free of your suffering habits. You want to see reality more clearly. And if you don't want that, then maybe the teacher has another function, but you should be clear that that's they may have that idea that their job is to help you see. We use the language in my lineage of where you're stuck. It takes trust. You have to trust that a person, first of all, has your best interest in mind. That their intention is compassionate. And that they've done this long enough, or their study of the self is thorough enough that they can actually see those things in somebody else. So I can see some other people's habits of mind just because I've recognized them in my own zazen. And I've digested them and clarified, what is this about? This particular kind of attachment. How does that happen? And my teachers have reflected to me. So one example from my life, Chozen Roshi, one of my other teachers, she for a long time was trying to help me see that I carried around a grumpy attitude. Because I had really come forward. Part of my ordination vow was I vow to follow your guidance and learn from you and to wake up. And I was unconscious about my negative attitude. I somehow took it for granted, and I just kind of would walk around with a scowl. And it was unconscious. I think I would just wake up like this, you know. Once in a while I'd go, but mostly this was like my default. And to carry around that attitude is a kind of suffering. That's not intrinsic to our nature, to be pessimistic or grumpy, is it? So what she would do, and I hated this, it was so painful. She learned that telling me about it kind of irritated me, and I would get reactive. And I would just kind of say, well, look at Bodhidharma, doesn't he scowl, and there's nothing to be happy about, samsara's, you know, terrible. I would rationalize somehow. So that didn't work. So what she started to do is, when she noticed I'd make that face, she'd just come up to me and go, and just do the same thing. And it was really powerful, and it was really painful. But little by little, from having her giving me the permission to be mirrored, it heightens your awareness. It turns up your sensitivity to patterns. Teacher can't make you let go of anything. You know, the Buddha can't get inside your mind and let you let go of your stuff and be aware. I wish she could. Can't do it. But teacher can remind us to do it. So that's part of the mirroring function that I think is so valuable. So another aspect of this is very similar, is that now a teacher can do this, but so can a good friend or a therapist or anybody. But it's to provide us with perspective. And it's not necessarily that they have a superior perspective. It's nice if they do. And by superior, I mean one free of, like, fixed opinions. But that they can see that we're in a particular perspective and offer a balancing or a broader perspective. Another saying I remember from Dogen Zenji, he says, when you first start practice, you're like a person who looks at the sky through a bamboo tube. And you're always doing that. And you're always, you're never seeing the whole thing because, first of all, you're limited as a human being. You can only see from where you sit and your degree of experience and your awareness. but also in each moment we're in a perspective. You know, for example, so let's say we talk about a situation at work with somebody. If we take up the perspective of a big problem going on there, usually we get locked in the perspective that what's going on is a problem. And the more we talk about it, we're in that same voice of, oh, there's this big problem at work and everything is wrong, and that's the whole reality we're in. But somebody from the outside could say, whoa, you're just seeing it like that. Maybe that's not the whole picture. Maybe this is fine. Or maybe you could see it like this or like that. Maybe this is an opportunity. So I feel personally very grateful from all I've learned from my very human teachers. I feel grateful for all I've learned from the imperfect texts, imperfect nature also as a teacher. In a way, there's nothing we can do about this. You just can't decide all of a sudden you're going to be like this, a super permeable person, and the universe is going to rush forth and flood you with great lessons. It might be that this is an automatic function of life. It's an automatic function of life, and what we can do is just acquiesce to it. Tune in and acquiesce to it. And certain things help, like prayers and intentions and stepping into the Dokusan room, perhaps. That can be that gesture of permeability and just coming forward like that. So, the real problem is the closure. The real problem is the times of closure. The openness, we can invite it, and it's wonderful, and we learn, but the problem is the closure. And then what do I do? And I don't just mean closure to like the Dharma or Buddhism with a capital B or your teacher with a capital T, but the closure when I feel like life has become deadened. I start to experience a dead world, that my everyday life doesn't have any light or any magic. What do we do about that? How do we recognize that, and how do we break free of that? So last thing, sort of complete my random spewing forth of contemplations I have, is what Uchiyama Roshi said, that Zazen is your true teacher. And that's got to be something bigger than sitting here on this platform on some black cushions. Zazen is your true teacher. And how to stay open to that? How to be Zazen as a query rather than a technique, as like be Zazen as poetry rather than a tool to kind of fix you, to kind of cut out the parts you don't like and maybe put in some parts you do like. So there's this truth we touch that in a moment of fully immersing in Zazen, that moment is complete. That moment is whole. This life is not broken. In a moment of true immersion, there's no opposite. There's no friction. And yet, so Dogen says, revere the one who is beyond learning. In Fukan Zazengi, revere the one who is beyond learning. And at the same time, or maybe at a later time, he said, my life has been one continuous mistake. So that's that student mind and a very interesting conundrum of our practice. So I'm curious if you have any reflections or or insights about this topic? Challenges maybe you're facing with this? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've been kind of working with that.
Yeah.
Working at that. And not just myself, but the students as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. So the first thing that comes to mind is as a senior student, we need to embody intimately processing our conflicts with our teachers rather than leaking them out. Because people who are less mature in the practice, if their faith is wobbly, they can hear our struggles as something's actually wrong. But as, if you've worked with a teacher, if you've gone the distance with a teacher, you know that everything that comes forward is not always the right thing and not always the ethical thing. I'm not making that kind of excuse. But everything is something that can be learned from. And so it's maybe the teacher's, the real thing is, why are you irritated with your teacher? Or why are you disappointed? And that's a really intimate question. What fixed belief do we hold? I was lucky that experience I shared with Hogan, I trusted him right away. And so I trusted his intention. But I didn't always trust his insight in the practice. I didn't trust the depth of his realization right away. And especially as I was younger, I had these ideals of an enlightened person or an awake person. And actually, we're always seeing through our ideals. And that's part of what comes up in the teacher-student relationship, is that our ideals of how they should be are really a projection of what we want to be or what we think we should be getting from the practice. And so this person is either meeting those, which then we think they're great. We tell everybody how great our teacher is. Or they're not meeting those ideals that are ours. They don't belong to the Dharma. They belong to our minds. And so we're up against our own ideal. So I watched that process play out with my teacher, and what I think was important is I feel like I have direct experience of his depth of experience in the practice. But I also had to accept that a lot of what I expected from a teacher was just my own insecurity, wanting someone else to have everything, all their ducks in a row, wanting there to be a perfect human. All of that stuff that, all the human inadequacies, I was hoping somebody else somehow didn't have them. And I was going to find them in a Zen robe. On the other hand, I'm sorry, I'm just kind of babbling here. I drink a lot of tea. You know, it's said in the Vajrayana that you should really check out your teacher. You should watch your teacher. It's right that you scrutinize your teacher. Fundamentally, ethically, if that matters to you, a teacher's conduct, you should really watch them. That's their burden, that they are watched by the Sangha. And that actually helps their practice. So you scrutinize them. Do they do what they say? First of all, do they live what they teach? And do you have a fragrance from this person that they know the equanimity of Zazen? So you've got to see them in difficult situations too. Because you have every right to be shopping for a teacher, actually. For a while, you know. At some point, it's important to settle on somebody and commit to that relationship. But you have that's your human right to discern if a person is who you feel you can learn from. see this gentleman in the back. Any suggestions
in terms of where you should benefit others who are not the regular sitter, but very much open and willing to learn?
Oh, man.
How can we work together to more embody something like this together when issues come up?
Yes. How long have you been in your relationship?
30 years.
I think you could tell me a lot more. Would you be willing to share one of the number one things you've learned about your partner as teacher?
She never gives up. she's always willing to be there and really present, no matter what. And really supportive of me all these years. We've been married 25 years.
Beautiful. Yeah. There was one Zen teacher who came to this country very early on, and there were all these students who were really sincere and wanted to kind of run off and become monks, and he said, no, you should just get married. He said, that would be the best ordination for you is to be married. I'm in a partnership, so I understand a little bit of it. Be married, because in committing to that person, you'll see all the places where you hold back love. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's just when things come up, if there's any kind of suggestions you might have as to how we might deal with conflicting issues.
Well, I think blame is never useful.
Yeah.
I come back to one of the number one things that makes us a practitioner is that we take responsibility for our own state of mind. You know you're really practicing when you've transcended the victim perspective. And I don't mean people who are actually oppressed or abused. That's another issue. But in your day-to-day experience, if you have stepped out of victim perspective, you're settled in the practice. And so it's just, I bow to my partner, you know? Yeah. Okay.
Not always very successful, but I work towards that so that my teacher can say something and then I'll be able to hear that thing. That might not be quite what I'm really feeling like when I hear it, but would be useful for me.
Yeah.
So that, and that dynamic, it's very hard to have that dynamic in any other setting. But in that setting, the understanding is there. Both of you have that understanding that this is a different type of communication and that that can happen.
That's lovely. Two things came up. One is it took me 1,000 dokusans before I really went in completely empty. Meaning when the teacher was speaking, I wasn't retorting or I didn't find some defensiveness in my body. You know, it's always mixed up. We're always mixed. You know, we're Buddhas and we're deluded, and that's kind of, but, so it took, it's not easy, that's something that's not always easy to access. But what I've appreciated is I learned that from that relationship with the teacher, it's like a place where you can learn deep human intimacy. And now I know that state of mind well enough, I feel like I can access it sometimes with other people. But I needed that container of trust in order to learn that. That it's totally okay to be undefended. Doesn't mean that it's always wisdom coming out of the mouth, but I can be that receptive. Yeah, thank you. Good, is it a good time to end? Yeah, okay. Well, thank you all for your practice, and thank you for letting me join you here. Thank you.